Welcome to the Herpetile Podcast. My name is Nash and I love herpetology. This podcast explores all things to do with reptiles and amphibians. I hope you like it. Welcome to the show. My name is Nash and I'm the host of the Herpetile Podcast. My guest today is Steve Elaine. Steve is a zoology graduate from Anglia Ruskin University, a master's graduate from Imperial College in London, and is currently completing his PhD at the University of Kent. He is currently researching barred grass snakes and their population ecology and ophidiomycosis. He is the chairman of Cambridgeshire and Peterborough Amphibian and Reptile Group. He is also one of the council members for the British Herpetological Society. He also was an intern for the IUCN SSC Amphibian Red List Authority, where he focused on red listing of southeastern amphibians. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
My first question for you today is, how and when did you first become interested in working with animals?
That's a hard one to answer, but I suspect that it's the same case for most people, in that my fascination for the natural world started from a young age.
Mm-hmm.
I think I must have been about 4 or 5 years old at the time, and really got into watching nature documentaries as well as being outside of the natural world. It just really captivated me, and I haven't looked back since. I've been trying to carry on that career path and make a career out of things since then. And here I am today.
I read on your website that you think British herpetofauna are undervalued. Can you explain more about that?
Of course, yeah. So, unfortunately, we only have 13 native species of reptiles and amphibians, 7 amphibians and 6 reptiles. And I think that they're underrated. A lot of people tend to overlook the fact that we have native species of lizards and snakes, and instead focus on other places such as the tropics. And I think that's because A, there's a lot more species, and B, that they're more colourful and therefore more attractive.
Yeah.
But our own species are, just as cool. And unfortunately, there are quite a few knowledge gaps. So, with my study species, the barred grass snake, there are, lots of gaps in their ecology and just general information about them that is quite surprising for quite a widespread species in a country such as the UK. So, it's surprising that those gaps are there.
So, you think that's for reasons that people would want to study tropical animals like eyelash vipers or cobras or stuff, because they have colourful patterns and there's more of them?
Potentially, yes. So I think one of the issues is that the native species aren't seen as being as attractive as the tropical ones, and possibly not as important because some of them aren't as threatened as other species that there may only be a handful left, but they're silently being neglected, and so the populations are declining. In 2016, a piece of research was published that showed that, unfortunately, common toads, Bufo, one of the most widespread amphibian species in the UK, had declined by 68% over a period of 30 years.
Wow.
It is very shocking. But up until that point, there's a whole host of reasons. So habitat loss, fragmentation, pollution, all of the usual suspects for when it comes to species decline.
So you've done a lot of field work overseas, right?
I've done some, yeah.
Where has it taken you?
Where has it taken me? So I've been abroad in Europe a bit, so places like the Netherlands and Germany, but also to Africa, to Tanzania, and then to Southeast Asia, Malaysia, and Singapore.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite of those places?
Malaysia is probably my favorite, just because I was there for the longest. So I spent 3 months in Malaysia, tracking and surveying frogs on Mount Kinabalu in Sabah, and that was fun. The weather wasn't always on our side, but it's an experience that I'll never forget.
Did you learn anything from it? Like do a paper or anything about it?
So it was all for a colleague's PhD. So me and my colleague were out there helping her collect data and conduct the surveys necessary for her to do so. And yeah, so unfortunately, it hasn't been a paper from it, as we were just assistants at the time. There may be down the
Yeah.
line, but I'm aware that there's still a whole host of data and analysis that needs to be done still. But that avenue is still open in the future, and I suspect that if I do conduct any other field work abroad, in the future, then hopefully there'll be some research outcome at the end of it.
By the way, I just realized you might be able to hear baby ducks I just got today actually. But you worked on a red listing project. What was it? Was it was amphibians, right?
It was, yes. So I worked with Jodie Browley and a team from the Australian Museum to red list amphibians from Southeast Asia. And so it was my task to help red list amphibian species that had recently been discovered on mainland Southeast Asia, and try to assess them for the Eocene red list in order to work out how the populations were doing, what sort of conservation actions needed to be implemented. Unfortunately, for most of those species, one of the main threats was habitat loss, either due to illegal logging or expansion of agriculture, or just increased urbanization. So some of them were fine, but there were a couple there that we were quite worried for. But hopefully, now we know what the threats are, something can be done about them.
What is ophidiomycosis then?
Okay, so ophidiomycosis, which is one of the research topics for my PhD, is what was once known as snake fungal disease. And so, it's a fungal pathogen that attacks the skin of snakes. As far as we're aware, it's only snakes at the moment, and yet it can cause a whole host of deformities, which stops the snake being able to eat or feed, which then leads to starvation or dehydration. But it can also just weaken the snake's immune system and lead to death by secondary infection or predation. So he carry on.
Is it like are the chances of the animal dying 100 or?
It's not, no, it depends on the species. So the disease has been known about for some time in the US, and there's a whole host of species there that are affected. Here in Europe, there's only a handful of species that have so far tested positive, and my study species is one of them. And at the moment, I'm trying to establish what the survival rate is in infected snakes, and there's no evidence at the moment to suggest that it's going to be a problem for the snakes, but you know, I still need to collect more data and analyze it to figure that out for sure.
So you're currently researching barred grass snakes. Does it affect them?
It does, yes. And again, to what extent, I'm still not sure. But a number of the snakes I've been surveying and monitoring have tested positive. And I am in the process at the moment of trying to work on the scoring system to be able to, you know, try to subjectively work out how it affects each snake individually and therefore how it affects snakes at a population level.
Is that all the research you do on the barred grass snakes, or is there anything else?
It isn't, though. So, you know, I'm also looking at, demographics, looking at age, looking at, the sex of the snakes, looking at their, you know, when I'm out surveying the snakes, I catch them and I take a whole host of biometric data, so their weight, their length, all of that sort of stuff, as well as swabbing them for aphidiomycosis. And yes, all of this is still coming together. Unfortunately, because of the current pandemic, I can't be out in the field to collect more data this year at the moment. So, you know, I'm just sat at my desk trying to make sense of the data I have already. So, yeah, I've gone slightly crazy with modelling data over the past, you know, month or so.
You can go.
I'm currently in the process of trying to answer a number of my questions and then work out, you know, what needs to be collected data-wise moving forward to continue answering those questions.
So it sounds like you do a bit with artificial refugia. What is that?
Yes, I do use artificial refugia, yes. And so they're also called artificial cover objects, or ACOs. Mm-hmm. And I use a corrugated bitumen sheet that's usually used for roofing garages and sheds. Although you can use carpet tiles or roofing felt or corrugated steel sheets or planks of wood. You know, there's a whole host of different methods for surveying temperate reptiles. It doesn't work too well in the tropics because the environment tends to be more stable.
So what's it for?
So essentially you put them out at your survey site, and it creates a favorable microhabitat for the local reptiles, and you know that they gravitate towards them and bask underneath in the morning when they're heating up before they go out and do their reptilian thing. And it's just a way of increasing your likelihood of finding reptiles at the site.
So you'd like put it down and then you'd check it when you want to do a survey to see if they're there.
Exactly, yes. So generally you put them down, you know, a couple of weeks in advance to let them settle and, you know, let the local reptiles find them. And then you'd come back afterwards at a regular interval, either in the morning or in the late afternoon, and, conduct your survey and then see how many snakes or lizards that you're able to find.
Yeah. So you've also done research on midwife toads.
I have, yes.
Do you know why they're called that? And what was your research? Did you find anything?
So the research is still ongoing. And they're called midwife toads because the male midwife toad carries the eggs for, a set duration of time between roughly 2 and 6 weeks, depending on the environmental conditions.
Yeah.
And so the research that we've been doing is that here in the UK, midwife toads are an introduced species. And, there's a few concerns we had. One of them is relating to disease, whether or not they could be a vector of the amphibian chytrid fungus or other diseases to our native amphibians. And then the other question is, where do they come from?
Mm.
And so we've done some limited disease screening of midwife toads, and so far everything's come back negative. And, you know, that isn't surprising, seeing as midwife toads are one of the most susceptible species in Europe, amphibian species, to the chytrid fungus. So if populations were going to persist, you'd expect them to, you know, be disease free. Some of them have been recorded, you know, in the UK for over 100 years. So, you know, they've persisted that long. And then in terms of origins, you know, so some of these populations have, you know, the local residents where they're found, you know, have a whole host of different stories as to the origins, and there isn't really anything documented in the scientific literature. So, yeah, we've been busy taking DNA samples from a number of the populations and comparing them to an online reference database to be able to figure out where the toads came from. Again, we were hoping to get out this summer and collect some more samples to fill in the few gaps that we have. But yeah, it may have to wait until next year now. But yeah, we're slowly getting there, and we're hoping to have a publication ready. Well, it was going to be the end of this year, but we'll see how it goes. But you know, we've got some interesting preliminary results. We just hope that those results continue through to the other populations that we hope to sample to.
So then, can you tell us a bit more about your website and blog?
Sure. So my website is essentially a home for everything that I'm involved with, and, you know, has you know, links to all of the science communication that I'm involved with, as well as you know, my publications and, you know, my experience and everything. So it's sort of like a, you know, an online CV, as well as, you know, keeping everything together in one place. And then my blog, you know, my blog is just a way for me to communicate multiple things with people. So, you know, I update people on my research, I write book reviews there, you know, I try to engage as many people as possible about what I'm up to and what I'm doing, so that A, you know, people can recognize that scientists are, you know, as normal as everybody else is, and B, so that, you know, hopefully somewhere down the line, some of these kind people fund my research. But and it's great to get, you know, keep people involved in what you're doing, especially if they care, or if not, it can inspire them as well. So yeah, I always like to reach you know, a lot of different people from different backgrounds, to engage them with my research, so that, you know, that they can find out about stuff that they wouldn't otherwise or normally know about, and, you know, hopefully somewhere down the line, you know, they can use that information and potentially, you know, it may lead them into, you know, a career in conservation or science as well.
So, so do you keep any animals?
I do, yes. So I only keep two species at the moment. One of them, so I keep some alpine newts. And again, alpine newts are an introduced species here in the UK. Where we have quite a few introduced reptile amphibian species. And the ones that I have were caught whilst surveying for great crested newts, our largest newt, which is also legally protected. And yeah, so if you come across a introduced species, then it's illegal to release it back into the wild. So you either have to euthanize them or keep them in captivity. And and yeah, so I've got four alpine newts that were caught during routine monitoring of great crested newts, and so couldn't be returned to the wild, and instead they live in a tank here in my house. And I also have I recently got these guys in December. I've got a small tank on my desk with a handful of Hymenochirus, the African dwarf frog, in there, which quite an easy species to keep, and it's just something for me to watch when I'm working at my desk. But also I'm hoping in the future to breed them. But a friend gave me a couple, and I'm grateful for that. It's a Christmas gift, and now they're just living here happily, watching me, and I watch them as I work. So, yeah.
Are they in the same room as you right now?
They are, yes. Yeah, so I'm currently looking at them as I speak to you.
So getting a bit closer to the end now. If you could tell everyone in the world something about reptiles or amphibians, what would it be?
Oh, no, this is a good question. What would it be? So I think the main thing that, I try to overcome, or at least educate people towards, is that, reptiles and amphibians aren't how they're portrayed in the media. People always think the snake's going to be slimy, or that they're going to be out to attack you.
They feel nice.
Exactly. In actual fact, that they're not slimy at all. They're quite dry, and depending on the species, rough or smooth to the touch. And most of them are completely chill. It just depends how badly you make them angry as to whether or not they're going to chase after you or not. But most of the time, they want to avoid people at all costs, and so will slither away before you've even seen them. That's one of the great ways for using artificial cover objects, is that the snakes feel comfortable, as well as the lizards and other stuff feel comfortable underneath, and so they don't immediately try to run away as soon as they feel your footsteps coming. It isn't until you lift it up that they realize that something's going on and they try to run away. I think that misconceptions are my main take-home message, is that whatever you think about reptiles and amphibians, the opposite is probably true. I don't know why some people have fears of frogs, because most of them are bright green, they've got these big eyes, and they just want to hop and jump everywhere. Maybe that's why it freaks people out, because they can jump multiple times their body length. But I think that once you've been exposed to reptiles and amphibians in the right environment, if it's controlled like at a zoo or a wildlife park or whatever, that those fears start to disappear, and people can then start to see things in a different light.
And the only species that would have like a chance of chasing you might be a bushmaster. Not much would chase you.
No, of course not. No matter how unfit you are, as a species, we're quite athletic compared to most, and it's unlikely that you're going to be chased down by a snake or even a frog. I'm just trying to pick that in my head now, it seems very unlikely. But I suppose when you have an irrational fear, everything seems rational. I think if you have a fear, try to face it, and hopefully it will change your perception of these animals, because they are under threat. 41% of amphibian species at the moment are threatened with extinction, and reptiles, the figure isn't too far behind. The issue that we have is that new species are currently being discovered all the time. So over the past 20 years, about 130 new amphibian species have been found each year, and most of those have been split off from more widespread species. We call these groups of animals cryptic species, because one of the ways to identify these new species is to use, DNA and other molecular techniques using modern technology. And it reveals that what looks like one species, because, you've just got a load of brown frogs that all look the same and all sound the same, are actually 2, 3, 4, 5, different species. And so the range of the the animals that you're looking at can, you know, shrink drastically. And one of the criteria for being endangered on the IUCN Red List is dependent on how big a home range a species has. So if you then you know, reduce the range of a species, you know, it, through these reclassifications based on DNA, then, you know, it can mean that you know, you'll find, you know, you're inadvertently finding more endangered species, which then you know, need conservation action to try to prevent habitat loss or disease, or, you know, whatever the main threat is. And I think, you know, that isn't always addressed, but it's something that I'd want to highlight, because, you know, although we're finding new species all the time, most of the time these new species are already endangered before, you know, before we've even found them. So, yeah, keep an open mind, and, you know, try to do what you can to help, you know, reptiles and amphibians, whether it be, you know, in a local area or internationally.
So my final question for you today is, what is an unusual fact about reptiles or amphibians that people might want to know or might not know?
Ooh.
Well, sort of similar, but...
What unusual fact should I go with? Oh, this is a tough one. there's something to choose. Okay, so I'm gonna go with an amphibian related one. So I apologise that, you know, I know most of your podcasts have focused on reptiles so far, and yes, I love.
Oh, yeah, that's good. I don't want it to be only reptiles.
And, you know, I love reptiles, but, you know, for a lot of my career, I've worked on amphibians, and only recently started to switch into the world of reptiles, despite working with both over that duration. And so my fact is in regards to Brazil. So currently Brazil has the most number of amphibian species for a country, and so Brazil has approximately 1,100 amphibian species, which is, you know, just over 1/8 of the total amphibian species found in the world. So yeah, it's a huge number. And, you know, there's probably many more waiting out there to be discovered.
Yeah. That's all you will say?
Yes.
Okay, thank you so much for being on the show, Steve.
You're very welcome.
Also, don't forget to check out Steve's website, which I'll add in the show notes. Bye! Thanks for listening to the Herpetile Podcast. Please subscribe so you don't miss out on any of the latest episodes. Happy herping!